This is Stop Think Science, Episode 10. On today's episode, we talk to Matt Stilwell about how microfluidic devices can be used in the search for new antibiotics.
If you're making a vinaigrette, you know, you take the oil and vinegar and you slash it up, and it makes those little bubbles, but they're all different sizes. I can do that same thing, but I can make all those bubbles the exact same size.
You are listening to Stop Think Science. Please buckle your seatbelts and put your tray tables in the upright position. You are about to embark on a journey through science and technology. Get ready to learn and expand your mind. Are you ready?
Welcome to Stop Think Science. I'm your host, Ian, and on the show today, we have our second host, Greg. How's it going, Greg?
It's going pretty good. How are you, Ian?
Good.
Today, we have my friend Matt Stilwell. Matt attended the Colorado School of Mines, where he graduated with his bachelor's in engineering physics. Currently, he's a student in the biophysics program at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where he is working on elucidating the nature of asymmetry in bacterial cell division. He also uses microfluidic technology to varying challenges and loves to teach science. Today's episode, Microfluidics, Biophysics, and More, we will learn all about what he does and how he got interested in science. Thanks for joining us, Matt.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This is exciting.
Definitely. Yeah. Thanks for coming on. So just to start off, as we have in previous weeks, we're trying to kind of get to the essence of what you do. And there's probably a lot of non-scientists that are listening to this podcast. So why don't you imagine that you're sitting on an airplane, you're flying to a scientific conference, but the person in the seat next to you, they don't have a scientific background. So take about 30 or 60 seconds and try and describe what you do in, say, non-scientific terms.
So I use this fancy new technology called microfluidics, which is basically the manipulation of very small fluids. And I use that in a couple different ways. And so one of the ways that I'm using it is to search for new antibiotics. So it's all over in the news that antibiotic resistance is a big thing. And I'm trying to use microfluidics to find new antibiotics in special ways. So that's the bare gist of what I'm trying to do with microfluidics.
So you use the word microfluidics. Could you go into a little bit more detail as to what a microfluidic chip is?
Yeah, so when we talk about size scales, you have like a meter, you know, which is about 3 feet for we users of the standard system. And as you start to go smaller, you get millimeters, and then the next step down is micrometers, and the next step down is nanometers. So microfluidics deals with channels that are about, tubing that's about the size of, on the order of microns. So you have micrometer-sized channels, and that kind of gives, there's special fluid properties, and we can exploit those to do pretty neat stuff.
I mean, so you use these, do you actually make the microfluidic devices yourself, or do you actually have someone else do that and you're doing more with what these can do, what kind of systems they can study, or?
Yeah, so we get to fabricate our own microfluidic devices, which is pretty fun. What we're doing is we're piggybacking off of the computer industry. So we have these incredibly powerful computers now, and to make such powerful computers in like a little laptop or on a phone, you have to be able to position things very carefully at a small scale. And so we can exploit that to build channels for fluids on that same small scale. And so, yeah, we go to this place called the clean room. We got to get suited up in your special gear, and you go down and you make little microfluidic devices, and it's pretty fun, honestly.
So how do you use these microfluidics to, you mentioned, find new antibiotics that kill bacteria? What's the process behind that?
Yeah, so I got to kind of back up a little bit and give a little more background for that.
Okay.
So we can make antibiotics in the lab. You know, you guys are chemists. You can go into the lab and you can synthesize antibiotics that have never been seen before by the likes of bacteria. And you could walk to a pristine lake that mankind has never really been to. And you could take those antibiotics and throw them on the soil. And there would be things in the soil that would be resistant to those antibiotics. Which means that there must be things in the soil that are producing antibiotics that we've never seen before. And what's kind of cool is, you know, we have hundreds of different bacteria that we can grow in the lab, but that's less than 1% of the bacteria that are actually on the planet. And the vast majority of them we can't grow because we don't know how. Maybe they have special things that they like to eat. Maybe they have friends that they need to hang out with. And so what we can do instead is just rip out their DNA and chop it up into bits and throw it into a bacteria that we can grow. And so what I can do is I can make these very finely controlled sized droplets, an emulsion, if you will. You know, like when you make an oil and vinegar, if you're making a vinaigrette, you know, you take the oil and vinegar and you slosh it up and it makes those little bubbles, but they're all different sizes. I can do that same thing, but I can make all those bubbles the exact same size.
Which is where the microfluidics comes in.
That's where the microfluidics comes in. So the microfluidics gives us the ability to really precisely control the size of those little droplets. And I can put bacteria inside of those, and then I can kind of concentrate whatever they might be making, and we can use that to screen for new antibiotics that we've never seen before.
So bacteria will produce antibiotics to ward off or kill other bacteria in a specific area. Is that what you're looking for?
Totally. Yep. Yeah. So, you know, it's a tough world out there, and even for bacteria. So they gotta fight it off. They gotta fight each other. And so, yeah, lots of bacteria will make antibiotics. Funguses will too. There's a fungus among us.
So I mean, is there a lot of concern in this research field of making new antibiotics, but is there the concern, as there kind of is in the medical field, of making more and more resistant strains of bacteria, and that being something that we can't really control or have a handle on at this point?
Yeah, so that's a great question. Good question, Greg.
Thank you.
There's a lot of different types of antibiotics, and so they'll target different processes in the cell. So maybe the cell is trying to build its shell around it, and so we have drugs that will stop the bacteria from doing that. Or maybe they're trying to make new proteins, and we can throw drugs at it that'll stop that from happening. And usually the bacteria will get a resistance to one type of those drugs. And so really what we want to try and do is find new targets altogether, things that bacteria may not have resistance to. So if, you know, you have penicillin, for instance, the first antibiotic that we discovered, a lot of things can get resistance to that. But if we find a different target, then the bacteria won't have resistance to this new one also. Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of idea why we're looking for more.
Let's see. So when you're looking at these molecules that are coming out of these bacteria, how often are they new things that we've never seen before?
Yeah, not often from what we can tell. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty difficult to find those new classes of antibiotics. So in my research, I'm still in the beginning stages, so I haven't found anything cool yet. But there's people who've tried to do it. You know, it's tough. There's a lot of stuff out there, and it's tough to figure out what everything is.
What do you guys usually find? Are they like peptide based things, or are they like?
So everything. What's kind of cool actually is, I guess I was at a talk the other day. Apparently, every living creature on the planet makes what's called an antimicrobial peptide,
right?
Which are these little tiny proteins that kill bacteria. And so we have a bunch. Bacteria have them. So those are some that we could find. Usually they're what are called small molecules. And so those will just be, you know, a couple, maybe like 20, 30 atoms, something like that. Sometimes they're bigger, up to hundreds of atoms. But yeah, usually they're not too big.
Right. And so each bacteria. Even if we think about you, Matt, and Greg, and me, we all have different antimicrobial peptides, right? That's as far as I understand it. So each one of these bacteria, even if they're the same bacteria, you'll find different antimicrobial peptides in each one of those. So the scale of the number of these possible combinations is vast.
Oh, yeah. Very vast. It's huge.
So like we were talking about in the pharmaceutical episode with John, just you kind of have a lot of different things you have to look through. It's just like looking at screening different molecules that might have a hit against a certain disease. In this case, you're just looking at something that's biologically derived.
Yep, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
So once you get these, what do you do with these molecules? Do you guys do any testing or do you pass that off?
I think once I do finally get some molecules, then I'll graduate.
You can hand it off to a younger student.
Hand it off to someone else, yeah. And so they'll figure out more about what it is and how it works, how to make it better.
Well, I guess a lot of that depends on how much basic science needs to go into developing this project, because it might even be that you've done enough work by that point that once you make that discovery, as you said, you'll be ready to move on and someone else will take the torch. And their project will be all about screening those different candidates and figuring out what they can do. And yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, so I guess my questions are leading to more medicinal chemistry. We need to, you're definitely more focused towards the biophysics aspect and the microfluidics. So I'll keep my questions towards that area.
Well, I guess sure. The real difference is it seems like there's just more engineering problems maybe.
Right.
Yeah, so that's really what I've been focusing more on is the engineering side of it all and just trying to get the system up and running. Because once you get the system running, then you can start to use different types of bacteria, different combinations of them. And from there, you should be able to find a lot more of those antibiotics that are naturally produced by other bacteria.
Are there any specific challenges that are inherent to this project that that maybe you've already overcome or know that you have to work on in the future? Or is it mostly just the broad that there's so many different things that you can look at, I guess?
Yeah. So one of the big issues that a lot of people have run into is that they keep finding the same antibiotics that we've already discovered over and over again. And so to find new ones is getting harder and harder and harder. And so one of the big challenges that I'm hoping to overcome with microfluidics is that because we're using such a small amount of volume, you know, so we talked earlier about size scales going from to millimeter to micrometer to nanometer. If you keep going down, you get to picoliters, to femtoliters, if you're doing volumes. And so because we're using such a tiny size, we can kind of concentrate whatever they're making and hopefully have a more sensitive device than what a lot of other people are doing.
And that seems to be kind of one of the directions that science research is going these days, is smaller. As our technology develops, we can look at smaller and smaller systems, and sometimes you see different things happening, different properties of materials, maybe just from looking at a very confined area or volume.
Totally. You know, it's also kind of cool. Greg, you were talking about how as we go to these smaller and smaller scales, we start to see newer and newer things. You know, the first person to study fluids was Bernoulli, and he basically just went and sat by a river and was like, whoa, the water in the middle is going pretty fast compared to the water on the sides. And so he started coming up with all these, you know, different equations to try and explain that. And now that we're able to manipulate fluids at such a small scale, we're seeing physics that no one's ever seen before. So things that the whole history of humankind has never experienced. And so now we're trying to figure out new ways to explain that. And it's pretty exciting.
I feel like that kind of segues nicely into something that I don't think I've ever asked you is I'm curious about you. You studied, as we said in the intro, you studied physics in college and now you're in a biophysics program. And I feel like that you're still dealing with engineering principles, dealing with math, as you mentioned. But what sparked your interest to work in a microbiology or more biochemistry-based field?
Yeah, so that's another good question. The first lab that I ever worked in was a laser lab, and we did stuff for making new types of solar cells. But I didn't really like the work that much, and so I switched to a different laser lab that did stuff that it was more of like a biotechnology lab, and I really enjoyed that. And so me and my naivete and my hubris thought I, as a physicist, I'd be able to make huge strides in biophysics. So I thought I'd give it a try. And I've definitely been humbled by that experience.
Yeah, I guess it just seems like there's probably a knowledge gap to overcome there. Although we all hit that in our own ways in graduate school, but maybe you're taking a bigger leap as you hinted toward.
Yeah, I joined a lab that does work on bacteria, and all I pretty much knew about bacteria when I joined was that they were a thing. So there was a bit of a knowledge gap when I joined.
But I think that's important in science these days. You, even though you didn't have the knowledge of the bacteria, that group didn't have the knowledge of the physics, right? So I guess you would say that's an advantage of looking at like biophysics as an interdisciplinary field. Would you like to elaborate on the relationship between, say, you as a physicist and someone else in the group is more of a biochemist? How do you work together?
A lot of times it's me just asking how to do stuff. You know, there's a lot of techniques that I don't know how to do. And usually the things that I'm able to contribute is things along the lines of data analysis. Whenever people have to do equations or programming, I know a little bit more about that, and so I try to help out when I can. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there's a lot of science is very interdisciplinary nowadays, and I think it's totally awesome. We kind of originally had drawn these lines in the sand of, you know, this is physics, this is chemistry, this is biology. And now we're kind of realizing that those lines are just kind of arbitrary, and there's a lot of bleed over between them, and mm-hmm. it makes it a lot of fun because you get to see people from very different fields doing research together, and they can do a lot of really cool things together.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there are any distinct advantages of working in an interdisciplinary research group or an interdisciplinary field?
I like that you get so many different perspectives on how to attack a problem. So you have people who with different backgrounds, different ways of thinking, different techniques that they know. And so they have different ways that they can try and answer a problem. And you can put all those together and do some really high quality science that way, I think.
Yeah, I think I've mentioned this before on the podcast, I think, but it seems like, as Matt kind of hinted at, that we're moving towards a lot of the interesting problems lie at the divisions between chemistry and physics, or between biology and physics, or material science and biology. I mean, there's just a lot of different things you can do by walking across the hall and talking to a different kind of scientist.
Right. So it's actually kind of interesting. So if we think two episodes ago, we talked to a geophysicist. So that's the meshing of geology, the study of the earth, and physics, how the things on the earth interact. Last week, we talked to a material science or a polymer chemist. And if you go back and listen to that episode, you'll see that material science is just about every science combined. And now we're talking about biology, biochemistry, and physics. So I don't think any one scientist is in any certain category. I mean, Greg, you are a chemist, but you're in materials, you're all over the place. I mean, you're kind of inorganic even as well.
Right. I've had to learn some solid state physics for what I do, which I never thought that would be the case. So really that's what ends up happening as you move forward.
Yeah. Branch out, find new ways to grow.
Yeah.
So what's your favorite part of being a scientist?
My favorite part of being a scientist, I guess it's nice to know so much about science. I really like talking to people who are not scientists and getting them excited about science. I think that that is such a powerful and fun thing to do, because, you know, our whole technology, our whole society is built on technology and science, and it's surprising how little most people know about science, me included. And it's really fun to get people excited about science and getting them to want to learn more about it. And so I like knowing that much about science where I can get people excited about it.
Do you think that education or outreach of some sort is in your future?
I sure hope so. I love doing outreach. It's what keeps me going.
You are a scientist, and as we found out last week, not all scientists have worst moments, but a lot of scientists have points in their, like, their academic career where, I don't know, things don't work very well, the science isn't working, and you just kind of want to give up. So why don't you go ahead and tell us about that time when you kind of just wanted to give up, if you have that kind of moment to talk about.
Oh, yeah, I definitely do. I think it's an important part that everyone kind of has to go through in science, which is very frustrating when you encounter it, but I think it is important for your growth. So for me, I had an issue with a collaborator. So one of the downsides of having interdisciplinary research is that it can be tricky to maintain these collaborations. There's a lot of communication that needs to be done, and there's a lot of coordination. And if you have slip-ups or you have lapses in that communication, you can start to have these little problems build up. And so that's kind of what happened with me, was me and my collaborator kind of needed to end up splitting ways. And so that was, it was hard, because it was a project that I really enjoyed working on and kind of had to just relinquish all control over it and try and grasp onto something else. So
that's definitely an important thing as a scientist, being able to realize when it's time to move on.
Yeah, 100%.
Well, also just the importance of working. I mean, maybe working the lab and working on a project by yourself, you tend to forget that managing personal relationships is also important to moving forward.
Yeah. What's unfortunate about we scientists is that we're also people and we have feelings. And so you got to make sure that, you know, when you're working with other people, you got to make sure that, you know, their needs are being met, and that, yeah, you got to, communication is key.
So with that said, do you have any advice for current or future grad students?
I think, you know, keep an open mind about everything. Try and do as many things as you can, and try and find things that you really enjoy. And when you do enjoy those things, pursue them. Because, you know, there's a philosopher, Alan Watts, who I really like a lot. And he talks about how it's so many people will spend their whole life trying to, you know, make enough money at a job they don't like, so that way they can go home and wake up the next day to go to another job that they don't like. And yeah, so keep an open mind, try and find something you love, and make that your living. You know, you should do what you love and love what you do.
So we're getting close to the end of the podcast here, and we've kind of decided that we're going to try and keep these under 30 minutes so you guys don't get too bored. So one last question. Do you have any favorite books that you're currently reading or that you have read that you might recommend for our listeners that are science related or something of that nature?
Or you could do what a previous guest did and mention one for more academic purposes and one for more pleasure purposes too. I guess we'll give you the option.
Or inspirational or whatever.
Well, I think I'm just going to say my favorite book series, which is The Song of Ice and Fire. I don't know if you guys have read the Game of Thrones series, but it's amazing. It's so good. And yeah, I'm a big nerd about it. I listen to all sorts of fan theories, and there's a Game of Thrones board game that I like to play. I'm a big dork about the whole thing, and it's a very well-written series. So if you like fantasy or science fiction or any of those, you should give it a shot. It's really good.
So you got involved before the TV show is what you're saying.
Yeah.
That's how you know a true fan. Well, Matt, we'd like to just to wrap things up, today we learned a lot about biophysics and kind of a lot about your story and how you got started in science and what you're doing today. And we'd just like to thank you for being on.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This has been a lot of fun.
If anyone out there who happens to be listening would like to hear more about these topics, we'll place some links in the show notes about the books that Matt mentioned and about a little bit about his research maybe. And you can look there for more content or send us a question. We can forward it on to Matt, and I'm sure he'd be happy to answer it for you.
Definitely.
Don't forget that we are on Twitter, Facebook, any of the social media that you may be interested in. So like Greg said, if you have questions, send them over to us and we will reply to every single question that we get. If we don't know the answer, Matt might or someone else will, and we'll find it for you.
We have a lot of scientist friends, if you can't tell.
Definitely.
So thanks for joining us again, Matt, and good luck with your research moving forward.
Yeah, thanks a bunch for having me, and good luck to the both of you.
Thank you.
Yep, thank you. We'll talk to you guys next week.
Thank you for listening to Stop, Think, Science. We are glad you could join us. Our success depends on you. Please subscribe to our show on iTunes. And if you're feeling generous, leave us a review. If you have comments or questions about anything that you heard today, don't hesitate to drop us a line at our website, www.stopthinkscience.com.